right, and we're back. Hope you had a wonderful weekend. Glad you're along tonight. We're going to explore some unusual topics, which we like to do here, as you longtime listeners know. And if you're new to the program, welcome. And let me remind you, there's a website that goes along with it. It is rense.com, R-E-N-S-E, where I bring you world news and national news and even some local news around the clock for you, 365 days a year. This news is the kind which in many cases you'll find not gathered together for you anywhere else, and certainly in many cases, not ever by the American media. We bring in material from all the news services of the world that we think are worth your time. Even if you disagree with something, remember, it's a positive exercise. If you only read things you agree with and that make you feel warm and fuzzy, you don't make any progress. It's good to get angry sometimes, and we try to do that at rents.com. We also spend an awful lot of time talking about things above us and the skies and beyond. And beyond that, we talk about things, of course, on the ground and our political situation with war imminent on at least a couple of different fronts right now. But we don't spend much time, not nearly enough time, talking about what's going on beneath our feet. And there is a lot going on beneath our feet, as we're going to find out tonight from our friend and colleague of many years now. He is Dr. Richard Sauder, Ph.D. That's S-A-U-D-E-R. And Richard has authored a couple of books. We're going to tell you how to get them later tonight. They are utterly unique. There is nothing else like Richard Sauder books. The first we're going to start talking about with is a particularly intriguing book. And Richard is the kind of a researcher who doesn't engage in idle speculation. He tells it like he finds it and can document it. The book I'm going to start with tonight is Underwater and Underground Bases. Official U.S. Navy documentation, accent on the official, that explicitly discusses putting manned submarine bases beneath the ocean floor, hundreds of miles out to sea. Official U.S. government documentation that discusses a national, that's coast to coast, or close to it, maglev train system by the year 2000. What, you say? Where is it? Good question. We'll talk to Richard about that and other things as we get into our program tonight. Let me remind you again to reload rents.com. Please, if you notice something amiss there, do send us an email, but many folks forget to reload it. You should reload that page about every half an hour to make sure you're getting the latest stories, because I do change it often. All right, with that, let's welcome our first guest tonight, Dr. Richard Sauder. Richard, welcome back to the program. How are you?
Hey, thank you, Jeff. It's great to be back. I'm doing fine. And, you know, I'm enjoying the new year, 2003. I look for good things this year.
What? What?
You know, I do. I look for good things this year. I had a conversation with a friend a few days ago over the Internet, and I said, you know, I can sense a little sense, if you will, a shift in the force. Not to say that means that the world situation will suddenly turn bright and sunny within a 24-hour period. I don't anticipate that.
I understand what you're saying.
But what I think is that there has been a, as I say, a shift in the force, and I think even George Bush, who is challenged in so many ways himself.
What a diplomat you are.
Can sense that this has, as this shift has happened. And I told my friend that, and I suppose many of the listeners will have seen the new movie, The Two Towers, and where the white magician Gandalf comes back in a blaze of brilliant light and tells the stunned trio, you know, I've come back to you now at the turn of the tide. Now, mind you, after that very theatrical entrance, there's still a lot of hell to come, if you'll excuse my expression. But what he's alluding to is, look, boys, the future looks very, very dark, and indeed, there is some darkness yet to come. But take heart. The situation as you perceive it now has within it the seeds of a profound and fundamental change. Give me a few days, and I'll show you what I mean. Mm-hmm. Now, you have to go watch the movie if you haven't seen it.
I saw it. I don't get too many movies, but I saw that, and it was quite an epic.
Yes, and he follows that up, and he says, look for me at dawn on the fifth day.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, they get caught up in all kinds of trouble and turmoil, and they forget about that until dawn is breaking on the fifth day. And, well, you have to see what happens. But in that spirit, I say, though I am not a Gandalf the magician, that I think that there's a little hint of change in the air. You know, it's still the middle of January, but you know, spring is on its way.
Well, it's been an unusually warm winter on the west and in the Pacific Northwest and in other areas, too, as well.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I agree. I think
this in a metaphoric way.
No, I agree. I see it and I understand. And I do think if by no other measure, Richard, than the amazing polarization of the informed, the enlightened, and the seeking elements of our society, vis-a-vis the programmed, hate-filled, reactionary right-wing elements of society, there has been a shift.
Let me tell you, Jeff, you and I read or look at multiple mass media outlets per day. That's your business. It's not my business, but I like to see, if you will, what the lie of the day is. And it has been my perception that a lot of these poll numbers that we're seeing may well be lies. I can conceive of major organizations like the Los Angeles Times, New York Times, CNN, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, making up numbers that will please their corporate sponsors.
Oh, it's too easy, of course. Sure.
It's extremely easy. And there are two ways to do that. One is to so rig a survey by contriving leading questions to elicit the response that the surveyor wants. That's the first way, and it's done all the time, by the way. The second way is to not even go to that much trouble. Just make up the numbers whole cloth out of thin air and plaster them in your newspaper or on the internet or on the TV screen. And I think there's a fair amount of that happening as well.
Oh, absolutely.
I think that the numbers of people who are either aware, already awakened, or in the process of quickly waking up right now are quite conceivably much larger than the mass media, the mainstream mass media, would have the American people to believe. It's a mind game. It's a propaganda game. And right now, I don't think it's working as well as these puppet controllers, or would-be puppet controllers, had hoped that it would.
Very well said. Yeah, I agree. I don't think it is, and I think you're right. I don't know how big those percentages are, but add to that mix those people, those Americans who are suffering from what is commonly called anxiety. And I think that the root of that anxiety is that inner direction that all of us have that says things are not right. And that whatever it is, they know something's seriously wrong. They don't have the tools. They don't have the data. But that's part of I think that's part of a shift, and I think you're right.
It is. I can sense it. And I felt it, you know, round about Christmas, I felt so bad. Everything seemed so dark and bleak, not just because the days are short and the sun sets so early in the evening, but in an emotional way, in a spiritual way, in a psychological way. But here, about maybe a week or so ago, very suddenly I felt, you know, something almost imperceptible. It seems trivial and slight and inconsequential, but yet I can perceive that something has just slightly shifted. The balance has moved, if you will, just one millimeter from one side to the other.
Uh-huh.
But it's enough to just barely flip across a threshold and start another chain of events in motion. That's the best way I can think of to explain it.
Well, that's optimism I think we can all embrace. And I think it's no matter what they do to us, they can't stop that kind of optimism, change.
Think of this. A month ago, we were hearing nothing but smallpox vaccinations, Where did that go? It went away. Why? Because people started waking up.
No, they rejected it. The hospital said no, and that's happened in here and in the UK.
And all we heard in recent weeks and months was this build-up to war, probably in the last week of January. Now it looks like it may not be until March, if then.
Well, they're saying now, the official line is, and I'll have the story up for you shortly,
yes,
is that there is a quote, logistics problem, which will put the war agenda back. See, they're blaming it. They're explaining it away on a logistics basis. Now, very interesting. All right, stand by. I'll be right back with Richard Sauter, whose first book, Underground, Bases and Tunnels, is probably in many of your libraries right now. He certainly has pulled that material out of the tunnel, so to speak, and brought it into the light for us for a long time. The newer, updated version of that book, Undersea Bases Included, will be on the table in just a few minutes. Talk to you then. Okay, and we're back. Jeff Rentz with Dr. Richard Sauter, Ph.D., who has really pulled some amazing material together with his two books, which we'll talk about this evening. By the way, that story I mentioned, USA Today, Richard, U.S. troops being deployed to the Persian Gulf will need until the end of February to be ready for full-scale war against Iraq, according to defense officials. This is really the first time I've ever seen a direct allusion by the Pentagon to a timetable for invasion. They were always trying to keep it up in the air. The delayed timetable has contributed to the Bush administration's willingness to tolerate extending UN weapons inspections beyond the January 27th deadline and into February, U.S. officials said Sunday, but it has not shaken the conclusion of key administration officials that Iraq will have to be disarmed by force. Now, on the other side of that coin, Chief Inspector Hans Blix is saying they want a year to finish their inspections. They'll need up to a year to do the job. So this is getting to be very muddy all of a sudden.
Well, I think the interpretation of these tea leaves is that, of course, Hans Blix's background is as a diplomat. And he, I believe, has the sound instinct that this standoff is not a situation that ought to be resolved through a murderous military invasion. Rather, it is a situation that should be handled diplomatically through the multilateral agencies that are in place, those being multinational agencies such as the UN, such as the Arab League, and so forth. And that's what he's really saying. That's code language that he's employing. That's understood in the international diplomatic community. It's also well understood by the Bush administration. Hans Blix is as much as signaling, look, I have your NATO allies behind me, such as Germany and France. The French and Germans are very nervous about this. And I also have, other nations in the UN, other members of the international community, including the surrounding Muslim and Arab nations in the region who don't want to see this happen. And that's what he's saying.
Well, today, the Saudis today put out a call for all Arab nations to oppose the invasion.
Well, I think the upshot of all of this is that there is not a groundswell of support for George Bush and his mad rush to warfare and invasion. Quite the contrary. There's a groundswell against him, personally, against his policies, against what the Pentagon is planning and preparing for. And those forces may yet have the day. as we're seeing now, they've already rolled the thing back at least a month and maybe 2 months. And if it goes much beyond that, of course, in that part of the world, it gets really hot in the spring and in the summer. And you cannot really wage modern warfare under those conditions because it's right above 100 degrees.
Well, it starts to move into the 90s on an average in May. So they've gotten until probably May at the latest before it starts to really cook.
Well, let's pray for a good result. Let's pray it doesn't happen, and let's work for a positive result.
Sure.
I think the clue is I don't vote because I regard it as a worthless exercise, number one. I don't even have any assurance that my vote will be counted,
right,
as we've seen in recent elections. But beyond that, I feel like through calling these alleged Congress critters and or the president at the White House switchboard and registering my opinion on various major policy issues, I at least talk with a live person who tabulates my opinion, yay or nay. And so, yes, thousands of other people may well call, and they do. But at least I know that my voice was heard, if only to that extent. When you vote, mm-hmm. you have any such assurance as we've seen over the last couple of years. No, you have no assurance at all.
Well, I first did the vote scam issue. I think it was probably almost 10 years ago now, and things have proceeded exactly as the Colliers predicted.
Oh, it's getting worse and worse.
Yeah.
And I don't know where it's going to end, but I have opted out of registering to vote because I regard it as basically a...
Well, it's almost insulting now, frankly.
Yeah, it's a fruitless mm-hmm. and non-productive exercise.
Right. Well, who are we voting for?
Well,
phonies?
We're voting for corporate
dupes?
Shills.
Exactly.
Corporate shills, empty, soulless husks.
With a tiny fraction of 1% exemption from that. But they're just garbage people.
Well,
maybe
have,
they don't start out that way.
You have the occasional Ron Paul
from
Texas or the Cynthia McKinney from Georgia who was defeated, unfortunately, in the past alleged election.
With outside money, we should hasten to add.
A lot
because
of outside money
yeah.
that came out of her district. And that was a shame because Cynthia was one of the few independent voices.
Talk about
in the United States Congress.
Well, you talk about conformity and the utter demand for it. You either conform or you're out.
Yeah.
That's the example. As if the Congress couldn't tolerate a Cynthia McKinney. We couldn't dare have someone up there who spoke of a different path. So they had to get rid of her. Just amazing. All right, we'll be right back. We're going to talk about the vice president's house and his neighbors who are not happy about something going on under his house. Richard Sauter is the only man I know to talk about this, and we'll do that in just a couple of minutes. I'm Jeff Rentz. Glad you're here, and please do stop by Rentz.com. Okay, if you happen to live near the vice president in Washington, D.C., you probably have heard what sounds like thunder, but thunder under your feet. AP had the story a couple of weeks back. Neighbors of Vice President Dick Cheney are being shaken and rattled at least once a day by mysterious blasts on the grounds of the U.S. Naval Observatory where Cheney lives. It's where the vice president's official residence is, since 1974, in fact. The Navy says the explosions are part of a construction project that has been going on for several months now. But it won't say any more because the project is classified. A spokeswoman for the Navy did describe the work as an infrastructure improvement, a utility upgrade. An infrastructure improvement, a utility upgrade. She said the Navy has tried to reassure the neighborhood, which includes the Washington residence of former President Clinton, that the blasts would not damage their homes. Joseph Reiser, who lives half block from the road upon which the mansion sits, said each blast was almost like thunder because it rolls and it lasts a noticeable period of time, probably several seconds. He said the explosions rattle windows that aren't shut tight. Now, this is a half a block away. So, Richard, obviously something major is going on. If this is some kind of an alteration, an improvement to an existing underground facility, it wouldn't surprise me. Are these blasts necessarily big to push that kind of noise and physical energy a half block, a block away?
Oh, yeah. You know, I've done blasting myself. I used to be a salt miner, and for a brief period of time, I was on the blasting crew, on the powder crew. Hmm. So I've worked with high explosives, and I've rigged up large explosions. Don't do it anymore. But I did.
Let's make that perfectly clear, because with Homeland Security, we don't want anything left untied up. No loose ends.
There you go. I am out of that business since I left salt mining more than 20 years ago. But I can tell you, yeah, you wire up a bunch of high explosives and it goes kaboom, and you can move a lot of material in a short period of time. And then, of course, you have to come in with some kind of mucking system and remove the material that you blasted. And then you have to drill and set up the next shot, put in more explosives, and wire up another blast.
Well, if this is being done under Cheney's residence,
yeah,
and there is no surface activity apparently visible by anybody.
Well, you have to understand, I used to, a number of years ago, live in the Washington, D.C. area, and occasionally my business would take me through that part of town. And the vice president's residence is on the grounds of the Naval Observatory, and it is a reasonably large piece of property, such that when you drive by on the street, you really can see little or nothing about what's going on within the gates. So that's not unusual. In other words, it's not a mansion that sits right near the street. It's set back. There's a fairly substantial lawn. There's a driveway. There are guards, etc. So you can't just drive by and you know, cast Google eyes at the vice president's mansion.
But let me ask you the question this way: does underground blasting to enlarge a shelter, make tunnels, does that require surface activity? Do you have to remove the debris?
Not necessarily. Not necessarily. And in fact, it would be my educated guess that there already are a fair number of clandestine tunnels crisscrossing the Washington, D.C. area at some depth. They would be deep tunnels, you know, hundreds of feet down, maybe even a thousand feet or more.
That's a long way down.
Oh, yeah, but well within the state of the art for the modern tunneling and underground excavation industries.
Well, for you newcomers, that's what Dr. Sauter really made his mark with, his first book, Underground Bases and Tunnels. And he knows, of which he speaks, there were tunnel boring machines that he has pictured in his current book.
Yes.
That were built when? In the 70s?
Well, you know, the tunnel boring machine technology has actually been around since the 1950s. Those were when they first came into use, and now their use is quite common, really worldwide. They're very efficient, and they'll just grind away through the rock underground, something like very powerful mechanical earthworms, if you will.
Uh-huh.
And they'll go right through the solid rock and make really massive miles-long tunnels. They can be 20, 30, 40 feet or more in diameter and just miles long, in some cases 10 or 20 miles or even longer. And so these things are definitely in use
and
in
this
industry.
And you can do this down 500, 1,000 feet.
Oh, yeah, no problem. In fact, it's done pretty routinely. Now, by a wide variety of corporations, government agencies, private organizations, transportation agencies, and so forth. And it's certainly done by federal government agencies, including the military. There's a subway in Washington, D.C., for which there have been many miles of tunnels bored in recent decades,
mm-hmm.
Below ground in and around the Washington, D.C. metro area. So there's nothing new about tunneling in Washington, D.C., but I would surmise that in the case of Cheney's vice presidential mansion and this most recent excavation, that there is certainly a clandestine expansion of that system underway.
Okay. Question for Richard when we come back. If you are digging a tunnel at depth, does the material have to be removed and brought to the surface? That material that is excavated and moved out of the way to create whatever it is you're doing. And by the way, some of these tunnel boring machines, as imaged in Richard's book, they're enormous. They look like they're science fiction devices. And the technology may be, and probably is, well advanced of that which we are readily able to access in our own research. Pausing and coming right back in just a couple minutes to bring you more on underground and underwater tunnels and bases. Okay, out of sight, out of mind is one way to look at it. Certainly, there is probably not too much more secret than what the military, and for that matter, some of the big corporations are doing and have done underground, right under our very feet. We've had innumerable reports over the years of noises, hums, vibrations, people reporting in or near their residential area. But what about digging at depth, Richard? Does the material have to be removed? Do they have to bring it out by some rail system or other system and deposit it on top of the ground like tailings from a mine?
Well, you know, I cover that in underwater and underground bases, and I also discuss that in my first book. I'm often asked that question. The answer is there are all kinds of ways to get rid of it. And, as you alluded, it is possible to remove the tailings or the excavated muck from within the tunnel itself, take it out usually by some type of narrow gauge rail car setup or assembly. Sometimes you can use a slurry pipe that is occasionally used to bring out the muck. First, you would grind it up to the size of small gravel or a coarse sand-like consistency, suspend it in a water solution, and then using hydraulic pressure,
pump it out.
You would pump it out.
Huh.
So there's at least those two ways to do it. Then, in the case of a clandestine facility, if you were excavating in an area where there were large natural underground caverns or empty magma chambers or lava tubes, you could conceivably store excavated material in those types of cavities without bringing it to the surface. There's also the possibility of concealing a clandestine tunneling project or underground facility construction project by masking the activity under cover of another industrial activity, such as a large civil engineering project like major highway construction, harbor dredging, a quarry, a sand and gravel operation, or a rock quarry, constructing of a major building, say, foundation for a huge skyscraper or some other large industrial project. So there are a number of ways that it can be done. And mind you, I get into the question in some depth of constructing underwater and undersea tunnels and facilities in this book as well. And one way that you can get rid of that type of material is to simply bore out a pipe or an outlet, if you will, to the bottom of a body of water, whether it be a large river, a bay, a gulf, an ocean, or a huge lake.
What do you mean, bore? Give me a visual image when you bore out an outlet.
Well,
let's say we're going to put something in the bottom of a big river, a secret facility.
Well, say that you come boring down a shaft from onshore, and you go down, say, 1,000 feet, and say it's a huge river like the Amazon River or the Mississippi River.
Don't get much bigger than that, yeah.
Yeah, the Mississippi or whatever, or one of the Great Lakes or the Atlantic Ocean. It doesn't matter. You would then simply use what's called a raised boring machine, which is a means of drilling a vertical or inclined tunnel at an acute angle up until you reached the bottom of the body of water.
Mm-hmm.
Now you would install a valve there so that when you drilled through, all of the water wouldn't come rushing back down the shaft you had just drilled and flood the facility. But you would put a valve there so that when you had the shaft under pressure and you wanted to flush material back out into the body of water, you could do that. And that way keep the water from rushing back in the reverse direction. And then under pressure, you would simply flush out the slurry. In a sense, would be a variation of the slurry technique of debris or muck removal that I mentioned a few minutes ago.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then ocean tides. Of course, if you're at depth in the ocean, there's no one to see it anyway. If you're doing it in a large river, you would probably want to do it during the spring floods when the snow and the ice melted, for example. And you would have a large volume of water coming down stream that would already have a lot of sediment that it would be pushing along.
I see.
And so you would just mix in the sediment that you had excavated with that and flush it away. It would get lost in the noise of the seasonal spring floods.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say it's been my observation that from just my reading in the popular press, that some of the large dams on the Colorado River in the southwestern United States appear to be silting up much more rapidly than the federal government had originally anticipated when they were built.
People rarely think about that, Richard. You know that? They just don't. They don't think about that.
I've been wondering about it. It would certainly be consistent with some of the things that I've read, and I also know from my research that the southwestern United States is very prime territory for very deeply buried underground bases. Indeed, there are some of them in that region already that are publicly known, as in New Mexico and Colorado. It would be my firmly based guess that there are some others that are not publicly known, and perhaps they have made use of this means of disposing of excavated spoil that I've just described.
Hmm.
I'm inclined to think that that's possible.
All right. Well, interesting. Now, there are and have been stories of tunnel systems all over Southern California, for example.
Yes.
They run from Long Beach to the desert, Palmdale, Lancaster, that run to New Mexico. I've seen maps. You've seen maps of alleged tunnel systems everywhere. And connected, of course, by probably maglev or some other kind of high-speed rail system. Now, if this sounds science fiction, The article in, I guess it was November's Fate magazine, which I sent you, Richard.
Yes, I actually purchased that magazine. It's fascinating.
Yeah, it in great detail talks. Paul Stonehill, a Russian emigre UFO researcher, talks about and shows photographs of German tunnels in eastern Germany and Poland, which he says were begun to be constructed in the 1930s. Yes. These are remarkable tunnels that apparently went for dozens, maybe 100, 150 kilometers or more. And they're not even fully explored, according to the article, to this day. And there are color photographs of them in there, and they they look state of the art.
Yes, that was during the Nazi period, and the Nazis did invest a lot of money and effort in building underground facilities. I might add, a lot of Nazis were brought to the United States by the Pentagon.
Oh, well, sure, thousands.
After World War II. Yeah. And went to work within the military-industrial complex. It would be my guess that some of them very well became involved in the underground.
Sure, they brought that technology with them. Yeah, well,
they brought that knowledge. They brought those ideas. Yeah. They brought that experience. And more than that, when the Americans and others went into Central Europe and occupied Germany proper, and also the areas that the Nazis had occupied and invaded, they saw these facilities, and they understood for the first time, I think, their strategic value, particularly in light of the United States' employ of the of nuclear weaponry in the closing weeks of World War II. And so I think that was one of the big impetuses for the United States to begin developing its own network of underground facilities. And as we see with the blasting at the Vice President's mansion in Washington, D.C., that underground excavation appears to be to continue right up to the present day.
Indeed, and goodness knows how many others. I would suspect you're the real scholar in this field, that there are hundreds of deep underground facilities all over the United States, not only government, military, but corporate as well. And these
I've seen references that lead me to believe that conservatively you could say that there are scores, and for all I know, more than that, scores being multiples of 20. I'm inclined to think that there could be a good number of them, and some of them very deep. And I want to emphasize that although the military agencies have certainly built underground facilities and some very sophisticated and large ones, that my research indicates that indeed there has been very heavy corporate involvement by the Fortune 500 and also by companies that are not of the size and wealth of Fortune 500 companies, but are nevertheless have some very powerful advanced technology for subterranean excavation. So the corporate sector has been very active in this field and for decades and continues to be. Now, they work hand in glove with a wide variety of government agencies, not only at the federal level, but also at the state and local level. And not only in the United States, but globally, many of these corporations are active not only here in North America, but elsewhere in South America, in Africa, in Asia, in Europe. Really, this whole underground excavation industry is a global industry, and I concentrate for the most part on the United States in my research simply because I have a hard enough time finding out what's going on here, let alone with the rest of the planet.
All right, we have to break. This article in Fate magazine, November issue, extraordinary because, among other things, the Germans were able to tunnel under lakes and bodies of water, which apparently when the Nazis pulled out, were allowed to flood these underground facilities, whatever they were. And allegedly to this day, there have been very little successful efforts to find out what those underground facilities were all about. More on that in future programs, though, as we pause and come right back with Richard Sauder. Dr. Sauder's book, Underwater and Underground Bases. Click on his name and check him out. Be right back.